here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, the colors of fall also come through in our cooking. Pumpkin, squash, carrots, and more. We'll talk about some go-to warm and filling recipes to help us embrace the cooler weather. First, the past few years have seen efforts around the nation to remove Confederate statues and other monuments from public spaces and to remove the names of white supremacists from college buildings and facilities. For many, it feels like an obvious choice to make to stop honoring those who fought to preserve the right to enslave African Americans and who, when they lost the Civil War, used other, often violent methods to terrorize or oppress people of color. Supporters of the monuments so that removing them is a threat to their identity and heritage. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're from the South or have lived there, how prominent were Confederate monuments? What do they mean to you, to the African-American community there, to local white residents? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Connor Town O'Neill's writing has appeared in several outlets, including New York Magazine and Slate. He works as a producer on the NPR podcast White Lies. Originally from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, he lives in Auburn, Alabama, where he teaches at Auburn University and with the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project. He joined us now for a look at his new book, Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Connor, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be with you.
Well, you focus on one particular figure, much monumented in parts of the South, Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Civil War general, ultimately for the Confederacy. Can you tell us a little bit about his story?
Sure. So Forrest was born in 1821, and in his early life sort of moves west along with the frontier as it sort of opened up after the Trail of Tears. He winds up in Memphis and makes a fortune as a slave trader there in that city, which is kind of the inland capital of the slave trade in the decades leading up to the Civil War. By some counts, he becomes one of the richest men in the South by profiting from that human trafficking. When the war breaks out, he uses some of that fortune to equip his own regiment he enlists as a private in the war, but becomes one of or the most promoted soldier of the war, North or South, eventually becoming a lieutenant general. After the war, he serves as the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, helping to undermine efforts at Reconstruction, and eventually operates a convict leasing plantation just outside of Memphis, a practice known as slavery by another name. So he's present at these real sorts of flashpoints of, you know, the racist history of America, but is also seen as this kind of instinctive military mind and is revered for that in monuments and names of schools and counties and cities across the South.
And did I read this right? There have been three U.S. presidents from Tennessee, and Nathan Bedford Forrest is more memorialized in Tennessee than all of them. I think you're right. Put together,
that's right. There are more markers to Forrest than to Jackson, Johnson, and Polk combined. So that tells you something about his standing in Tennessee.
Well, I want to step into the story where you first encountered the debate over monuments to Nathan Bedford Forrest. What was your entry point?
Yeah, so this is 5 years ago now, which is crazy to think about. I've been working on this book for 5 years, and it's finally out. So 5 years ago, it was the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the attack by Alabama police officers on nonviolent civil rights demonstrators, the late John Lewis among them, who suffered a skull fracture during that march. But it took place at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. And so I was in Selma 50 years later for that anniversary. President Obama was there to deliver a speech. And as was the case where a lot of places where Obama went, a ton of people showed up. I think some 40,000 other people showed up, and Selma's a pretty small city. So I had a tough time finding a place to park that morning. So I figured there might be a place to leave my car in the city cemetery. Selma's one of those southern towns that has one of those cliched southern cemeteries that think, you know, mausoleums, Spanish moss. It has its own system of roads. So I pull in there. It's just a couple blocks from downtown. And I think I'll stash my car there. I'll walk down and I'll listen to Obama's speech. And I wound up finding way more than I bargained for. As soon as I pulled into the cemetery, I see these signs that say Confederate Memorial Circle closed, no trespassing. And a couple of people sort of scowling in the direction of my car. And that's sort of catnip for a reporter. So I get out of my car and I approach and strike up a conversation with these folks and come to learn that they had really spent the better part of the last two decades fighting about this statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest that they had put up, where it should stand, whether it should stand. That statue was then eventually stolen. And then there was this big court battle about whether they could replace it or not. And when I met them back in 2015, they had just won that court case and were getting ready to replace the statue and dedicate a new one there in the cemetery. And the dissonance of that encounter, having this strange conversation with these neo-Confederates on a day of a major civil rights anniversary, it kind of gave me whiplash. I didn't know a ton about Forrest at the time, but this encounter raised all of these questions about who he was, what it meant to put up a statue to him in 2015, and to do it in a place like Selma that is synonymous with the civil rights movement and with Black voting rights. So I went down this rabbit hole of Forrest and his monuments in the months after that encounter, thinking, you know, there might be an essay there, something about statues and Selma and history. And then that summer, though, it all changed when Dylan Roof went to Mother Emanuel AME Church in South Carolina and murdered nine of the parishioners there and in an attempt to start a race war. And after he was apprehended and images from his blog started to circulate, it was revealed that he had taken this strange sightseeing tour around the state, visiting Civil War monuments, slave memorials, plantations, as a way to sort of steel himself almost for this act of terrorism that he would go on to commit. And so in the aftermath of that, campaigns across the country broke out to try and remove the Confederate flag from prominent places where it was displayed. And of course, campaigns to try and remove Confederate monuments as well. And because I had this really strange encounter with the Friends of Forrest specifically, I started following campaigns that were aimed at removing Forrest statues in particular. And so I've spent the last couple of years following campaigns in a couple of different cities and talking with the people that are trying to get them down and with the people that are fighting to keep them up.
For the people who were fighting to keep them up or to put them back up, they talk about Nathan Bedford Forrest as they talk to you in a present tense almost about fighting alongside him. Could you talk a little bit about their perspective, why they feel this connection and what they mean when they want a monument up?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand Forrest in contrast to someone like Robert E. Lee. Lee was, you know, one of the first, the Lees are one of the first families of Virginia. Lee, the sort of embodiment of the Southern gentleman, went to West Point. Forrest, you know, didn't go to West Point, hardly went to school at all. I think his supporters see him as something of a self-made man, although I use that with heavy scare quotes on it, because of course he made his fortune through human trafficking. But I think that's part of his memory there. And because Forrest didn't go to West Point, didn't start the war as a general, fought in the less prominent battles of the war, I think, you know, in the time since the war, increasingly people come to see him as, you know, what could have been if only Forrest had been given a more prominent role in the war than maybe the South would have won. So, you know, these days, the people that want to Monday morning quarterback the Civil War, as it were, really turn to Forrest as their great white hope. So, you know, promising that the South will rise again is a way of sort of turning to Forrest as the lodestar for a lot of that teeth gnashing and saber rattling. So yeah, I think that accounts for some of his popularity. I think of course they revere him for his instinctive military mind. There's a, and with that, a sort of, dismissal of expertise in favor of a kind of more natural, as it were, a more natural instinctive knowledge. Of course, though, it would be remiss not to say that it's no coincidence that the first Grand Wizard of the Clan that has so many monuments and markers of him throughout the South.
We're talking now with author Connor Town O'Neill about his new book, Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. He's a producer on the NPR podcast, White Lies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who do you think should get to decide who is commemorated or how in memorials? What do you think of the meaning of memorials to Civil War leaders from the Confederate side, especially ones associated with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan afterward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Connor Town O'Neill. His new book is Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Cross Plains. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I will admit that there are a lot of unsavory characters from history that we really shouldn't celebrate. However, I get really nervous when statues and monuments and memorials from the past are taken down at the request of a certain group or because that, like it or not, that is history. And I'm a firm believer that when you start whitewashing your history or changing or editing or circumventing it anyhow, you lose a little bit of that. And yeah, it might be something terrible, but that is history. You know, people that go, like, for example, you go to Auschwitz and you take the tour there, it's a terrible thing, but what better way to teach than to show it?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a common argument, Connor, but as you point out in the book, the putting up of these monuments was part of a big campaign to rewrite Civil War history in the first place.
That's right. Yeah. And I think it's important to make the distinction that monuments aren't history. History resides in books and in archives and in records. Monuments are about honoring someone. Auschwitz is not a monument. Auschwitz is a memorial and is careful to build a context not meant to honor what happened there, but rather to mourn it. And to attempt to reckon with it. So you know, statues of Forrest or Lee or other Confederate statues, they're not about telling the history of the Civil War. And like you say, you know, they really only start to go up at the turn of the 20th century after Reconstruction had been undermined and former Confederates had returned to power and started to implement, you know, white supremacist policies, Jim Crow laws. So the statues, I think, are an embodiment of that return to power and that return to, frankly, white supremacist rule. So they're not history. They're about intimidation and about a reassertion of a sort of old South ethos in the new South. And I think actually it's the referendum that we've seen in the last couple of years about Confederate monuments, Civil War history more broadly, and what we're starting to see with our founding fathers too, I think is not whitewashing of that history, but a real expansion of our understanding of the history and the consequences of that history. So I think the more people are thinking about how the Civil War history is still with us and how we need to tell a more honest story about what the Confederacy was and what it stood for and how the beliefs of the Confederacy long outlasted the 4 years of the Civil War. I think that's been really important and really urgent. So it means statues are coming down, but I think it means a better understanding of public history. So in that way, I think history is well served, by the attack on monuments that we've seen recently.
Thanks for that call. And that reminds me, you share a story in Memphis of a church leader who realizes their church is next door to, I think, one of Bedford Forrest's workplaces. And there's a little commemoration marker that doesn't tell a lot. And what did they do to try to flesh out the story?
That's right. That was a really powerful. That was a really powerful moment. So there's a Calvary Episcopal Church in downtown Memphis. In the parking lot of their church is, for the last several decades, has been a one of those blue historical markers to Forrest that says that his early business dealings were on this site. Or rather, his home was here, and references his early business dealings. Those what they're being coy about there is that his slave market was on that property that is now the parking lot of this church. And when a member of that church realized what was being obfuscated by that sign, and the fact that, you know, the church was operating in the 1850s while their backyard was Forrest's slave market, he decided that and with the agreement of the church, that they should do some truth telling about that, that they should really square up to the fact that, you know, at the early history of this church, it was next door to a slave trader and to that slave market. And so they held this ceremony, in which they found as many of the names of the men and women who had been trafficked through that market and read their names and unveiled a new marker that told more of the truth about what was happening on that site and attempted to be more honest about what had happened in that city. And I think it was really poignant because he points out, you know, that for the parishioners of that church in the 1850s, it would have seemed pretty natural. It wouldn't have seemed that strange that they were next to a slave market. It was just sort of the water that they swam in. And so one of the rectors at the church asked those present to really think about the ways that we're sort of swimming in injustice as well, and to use a reckoning with our past to help better sensitize us to injustices in the present. What is happening that we're not paying attention to now that we might be called to be more aware of and responsible for? And I found that really moving and important.
Talking to Connor Towne O'Neill, his new book is Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning With Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Let's bring on another caller now. Jane is with us in Oconto. Jane, hi.
Hi. I have to say I agree with you that they do not belong up, the statues, at least not on public property. Traditionally, historically, one erected statues, particularly of people in military uniforms and or on horseback, as a way to honor them, and we simply should not be doing that. They were traitors. They were trying to destroy the United States. They should not be on public ground. If some fool wants to put one up in his own backyard, go for it. But they should not be on public ground.
Jane, thanks a lot for the call. Let's focus on the public ground part of that a little bit, Connor, because that's an issue in at least some of the stories you tell, whether these statues should be on public property and what constitutes public property in some cases.
Yeah. I think Jane makes a good point. Because for these monuments to be on public property, you can read them, you know, as an expression of power, of economic power, of political power, of racial power, in the present, even though they're seeking to honor a figure from the past. They're also about, you know, the politics in the present day. These monuments don't just go up by accident, right? They're expressions of people, they're expressions of people wielding power. So yeah, and you can read who gets remembered, who gets immortalized, brought into the present with us through these monuments, as a reflection of the values of the place where they're standing. And to Jane's point, you know, these were traitors, you know, fighting explicitly. If you look at the documents of secession or the speeches that Confederate politicians were giving, they were telling anyone who would listen in the 1850s that the Confederacy was a project about protecting and expanding slavery into the West. And they were doing it on the explicit idea that the people that they were enslaving were inherently inferior by virtue of their race. So it's, you know, it's an explicitly a white supremacist project. They're fighting to create an ethno state. So to honor them on public property now tells you something about the values of that place where they stand.
Thanks for that call. And I want to spend our last couple of minutes, Connor, you talked to people, African-American residents in Selma, Alabama, and also and up in Tennessee as well, about what it meant to them to have forest monuments standing there or rebuilt in the middle of their communities. Can you share some of what you heard?
Yeah, one of the most poignant reflections I heard was from a student at Middle Tennessee State University, where there's a building on campus named after Forrest Hall. And they talked about taking a different route across campus to avoid the building because they didn't want to be reminded on their walk to 9 a.m. biology that their campus was honoring someone who didn't consider them a human being. And the I felt that I felt moved by that. That was, I think, a very incisive way to put it. Partly because one of the debates that was happening on MTSU's campus was whether they should keep the name, change the name, or keep the name with added context. That is to say, you know, put some plaques up around the building that explained why the school had chosen to name the building after this, when they named the building after after Forrest, and some of the motivations behind it and the fact that it was controversial, and doing a little bit more truth telling. And early on in the reporting of the book, I was curious about that third option, that sort of added context option. You know, what would it be to really tell the truth about why in 1958, 4 years after the Brown v. Board decision, but 4 years before the school would even actually integrate, what it meant for them to name a building after Forrest in that time period. And if they could tell the truth about that, I wondered if, you know, what whether that could be powerful a statement to make. But that comment from the student, I think, helped me to recontextualize how I was thinking about the question. That added context doesn't do anything to the insult and the degradation that these sorts of Confederate monuments and honorifics convey to people of color in this country.
Connor, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate you talking with me.
Connor Town O'Neill is a producer on the NPR podcast White Lies and a writer whose work has appeared in several print and online outlets. He joined us today to talk about his new book. It's called Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Coming up after the news, maybe you've been sad to see some of the warmer weather go. One of the good things, though, about fall is we get to turn our ovens back on and take out the crock pot. We'll talk about some of your favorite fall recipes with the public TV host coming up on this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, high-speed internet access, or lack thereof, has been a hot topic in many rural and small-town communities around Wisconsin. Kate Archer-Kent talks to a member of a task force tackling that problem, and you can join in with your questions and experiences. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Food Friday. Fall brings a change in the weather, but also a change in our kitchens. A lot of us might be happily enjoying some hot tea or other warm beverages and making some of our go-to soups, warm meals in the oven, and yummy fall produce. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite fall recipes to pull out once the leaves are changing? Do you have a favorite soup or maybe recipes for fall squash or other seasonal produce? What's your favorite thing about fall cooking? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christy Rost is a public television chef and host and author of three cookbooks, including Celebrating Home. She's a lifestyle authority and entertaining guru. Christy, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, Rob, thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here today.
Well, are you excited like I am when fall produce season starts to roll around?
I can hardly wait every year. You know, I love the summer and I love the light meals and all that. but I always long for fall produce and fall meals, those savory things, savory flavors and aromas. And oh yeah, and when all the veggies start coming out at the farmer's market, I am so there.
Well, we're on the same page, I think. One of the recipes you provided for us that we have up at WPR.org/Food Friday is a way to roast a combo of vegetables, and oven roasting fall produce is one of my favorite things to do. Tell us about your roasted glazed autumn vegetables.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, I have to say that when I created this recipe, I ran some of it next door to a neighbor, and I said, would you try this and tell me what you think? And she called me back within about 20 minutes and said, that is one of the tastiest things to ever pass my lips. And I, with a review like that, it's like, oh yeah, this is a winner. I knew I didn't have to tweak it. It was perfect just the way it was. And the thing I like about the roasted glazed autumn vegetables is that it depends a lot on just what you have in your crisper drawer and in the pantry. So in this particular recipe, I took a butternut squash, red onion, some turnips, sweet potatoes, carrots, and I peeled, chopped, and put them all into a large roasting pan, and then just drizzled them with some olive oil. Then I took a whole head of garlic, and I just, you know, separated the cloves, peeled them, chopped them just ever so lightly, and put them in with the pan, and added a little kosher salt, some black pepper, and then I roasted those for about 35 minutes or so, depending on, I was doing it at high altitude the last time, so because we have a home in Colorado, but right now I'm talking to you from Dallas, so there it took maybe 40 minutes for them to get tender, and then I took them out of the oven, and I drizzled them with some maple syrup and a couple tablespoons of brown sugar, and it doesn't matter if it's light or dark brown sugar, and stirred them up, stuck them back in the oven for another 10 or 15 minutes, and oh my gosh, I can see what my neighbor was saying. They are so, so tasty. And sometimes I don't have all of those ingredients. It happened, I wrote the recipe based on what I had a couple weeks ago in the pantry and in the crisper drawer. But sometimes I want the same flavors, but I don't have everything. So I may have some little red new potatoes or some, gold potatoes or something like that. And I'll quarter those and put those in. And that's really nice. It's also, you can take this recipe, break it down into much smaller amounts if you're having a meal for two. Or you can add lots of extra in if you have a large family. So it's very, it's one of these recipes that just kind of flows with what you've got.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Christy Rost, public TV chef and cookbook author, talking about great fall cooking. Now, I love oven roasted vegetables, and I'll do just simple. I'll cut up one kind of veggie, toss it in some oil, salt, pepper, whatever spices I want, and roast it. One key I've heard from a couple people that's really upped my game, Christy, is upping the temperature. I used to do it lower and slower. Your recipe, I think, is at 450, and going at that higher temperature really, it cooks it quicker, but it cooks it better, it seems like. Is that right?
It really does, because what that does, Rob, is it allows the veggies to caramelize. And when they caramelize, they're getting that browning on the bottom of the pan and a little bit of brown on their tops. What that does is it really heightens the flavor quotient of the recipe. Yeah,
and
if you cook at a low temperature, they just kind of steam in there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned there are turnips in this, and there are two kind of like, I don't know, people look down on them, they don't even think about them, the turnip and the parsnip. I like them. I can't sell them to my family for some reason. Do you want to give a little love to those humble root vegetables?
Yes. Well, the reason I put turnips in a couple of weeks ago, and that's the recipe that you have, is because I grew turnips in my Colorado garden this year. Ah. And because we're way up in the mountains at 9,300 feet, and we live in a historic home built in the 1800s, because we're up so high, this particular variety just didn't grow all that big because we had really chilly nights through a lot of the summer. And so when I harvested them, I looked down and I go, well, aren't you cute? You aren't huge, but you are cute. So I thought, well, I'll just buy maybe two large ones and then put all these darling little ones in there too. And I really like turnips. I think some people don't know what they are, and so they are afraid to try them. And I always think they taste to me a little bit like a potato that's got a little bit of horseradish flavor in it because it has that little spiciness to it. In a roasted veggie dish, they're super. And I will tell you, if it's my mom who's coming, I won't tell her that's what it is because by the time I've cut it up, it looks like potato.
9,300 feet. Well, you'd be looking down at Tim's Hill, our highest point in Wisconsin. You need binoculars
to
see all the way down there.
This is true.
Now, here's another one, another favorite of mine, actually, when winter squash comes around. Actually, just this weekend made, it's already gone, a butternut squash soup. And you've given us a recipe for it. It looks pretty good, too, for a butternut squash soup. How do you prepare the squash here? I've done it a couple different ways. My main way, I think, is your way for this recipe.
Okay. Well, you probably do what I do then. I take the squash and the butternut squash and I peel it and then I chop it up and put it into a large pot because this makes a lot, although I also have the recipe and that helps. I will saute some sweet onion, and I always use sweet onion as opposed to yellow onions or white onions, which are storage onions and never have as much moisture in them, and they make you cry more. So I always use sweet onions, and then lots of garlic. If you want to make a strictly vegetarian version, then you would use vegetable broth. Chicken broth brings out great flavor. And then I roast a pumpkin, and I just cut it in half. A butternut squash, because I do it both ways. But the butternut squash, I will turn it, cut it in half, seed it, put it on parchment paper on a large roasting cookie sheet, stick it in the oven, and roast it until it's nice and brown on the bottom and kind of fork tender. And then I cut that up, stick that in the pot with all the other things and cook that for a while. You can either puree your butternut squash ahead of time, or what I do is I just put it all in the pot in chunks, and then I add curry powder, which gives a really nice little extra flavor boost, and some salt and pepper, and then my secret ingredient is white pepper, just a whisper of white pepper. It gives it a real nice little kick in the back of the throat. And I heat that until the flavors meld and the squash has all that gorgeous flavor has come together and all. And then I set it aside until it's lukewarm. And then I put it through a food processor or something like that. The one caution I would say is never use a blender or a food processor when the product is hot, because it will explode the lid off. So you always want to wait until it's lukewarm so you don't get burned. And then I return it all back to a pot and cook it again and just let all those flavors come together. And at the very end, I'll add in some heavy cream. And that just, like, one cup of heavy cream is all you need, and it just really smooths out the soup and just gives this incredible flavor. And the whole recipe was inspired by a Rhine River cruise trip that my husband and I took several years ago from Amsterdam down to Basel, Switzerland. And in Basel, if you are familiar with it at all, has this incredible market square that's always been there since, you know, ancient times, since the 1500s, and a beautiful array of old buildings there. And we were there in the autumn, and at one of the booths, they had these huge Cinderella pumpkins, and some of them were cut into slices ready for people to take home and make whatever they were going to do with it.
Wonderful.
And I looked at those, and I took a photo because they were gorgeous. And I thought, oh, I'm going to make a recipe with that.
Sounds good. We're talking to Christy Ross, public TV chef and host and cookbook author, talking about great fall cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you been enjoying in your kitchen this fall? Do you ever make any homemade Halloween-themed treats? What's your favorite way to use your fall veggies? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Find some recipes from Christy at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our talk with Christy Rost, public TV chef and host. We are doing some fall cooking with seasonal produce. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your favorites, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have some butternut squash puree in the freezer from last year that I never quite got to. Is it still good, or should I throw it out and use a new squash?
Oh, my gosh, John, you're just like I am. Yep, those things end up in the freezer. And I will tell you, go ahead and defrost it as long as it has stayed frozen the whole time. Defrost it. It will weep. So just pour off the liquid after it's completely defrosted and use it as you would, whether you want it for a pie or for a soup or for muffins or whatever. It should be fine.
Fantastic. That's what I did Sunday. I used half my butternut squash for soup and the other half for the freezer for future reference when I'm desperate some yummy veggies later.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for calling in, John. We got an email, by the way, some parsnip love. Grant says, parsnips are my fall favorites. Peel them and oven roast until tender, then mash and use in a fantastic parsnip pie or process and add into bread dough with black pepper and a big drop of maple syrup added in. Few things are better in fall. Grant, thanks so much.
Oh, wow.
We talked turnips. That sounds like a pretty good way to use parsnips, though, doesn't that?
Oh, yes. That sounds like a wonderful way. I'm intrigued with the bread.
I kind of want more detail about that. I'm not sure how that all works.
Yeah, share it with me.
Well, speaking of sharing, I want to get into one more recipe you shared with us. This isn't exactly fall produce, but it's very seasonal. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday, a Halloween treat for meringue ghosts. Now, I've never made meringue. It seems tricky to me. Is it?
Oh my gosh, it is so easy to do, Rob. Oh my gosh, you know, with all the things you're making, you could master this first time out the gate. It's 3 egg whites, and I always keep them at room temperature before I whip them, and just a little bit of cream of tartar. Cream of tartar is an acid, and what it does when you beat up the egg whites, it helps increase their volume, and it will also stabilize them. And then about 3/4 teaspoon of vanilla for the flavoring, and you just whip all that together until it gets nice and foamy. And then I add very slowly a cup of sugar and just keep beating and beating until stiff peaks form. And when I say stiff peaks, you should be able to take the beater, hold it up in the air, and it should have a little curly cue on top and not move. And that is stiff peaks. And it will also get real shiny. And then you put it into a piping bag and you pipe the ghost. And I have the video and the how to do that on my Facebook page and Instagram. So anyone can go there. It's like 4 minutes, and I'll show you just how to pipe out that ghost. It's really, really fun. And then as you get farther into the holiday season, then skip the ghosts and move right on to snowmen. You just make, and of course it's Wisconsin. You guys have a lot of snow. So, you know, you just pipe a couple of round discs and put little chocolate chips in for the eyes and the button down the tummy and all, and you've got ghosts.
Spooky. Sounds good.
You've got snowmen.
Let's go back to our callers now. Russ is with us in Pleasant Springs. Russ, hi.
Hi. Years ago, before my wife passed away in the fall, she used to make a family favorite. And I don't know if it was butternut squash or what kind. It was a dark green, and I think the interior was pretty much yellow. Mm-hmm. And she would cut that off, scoop out the interior, mm-hmm. and fill it with fresh cranberries, I think. And maybe some brown sugar, maybe some white sugar to sweeten the cranberries. But I don't remember exactly what her recipe was and how long it went in the oven or whether it was covered with foil and what temperature it would have been baked at.
Were those kind of like each one was a personal size? Was it a large one?
Maybe 3-4 inches diameter across the bottom.
Right. That sounds like acorn squash. Yeah. And just if you want to recreate her recipe, simply rinse them, then cut them in half, scoop out the seeds. And there are two ways to cook it, if you have a lot of time or you're short on time. If you have a lot of time, you can put them in the oven. I fill mine with a little brown sugar, chopped apples. In your case, you're going to want to use the cranberries, maybe a tablespoon of butter, and stick them in the oven. If you are watching sugars, then skip the brown sugar and add some curry powder in there instead. That's very, very good. If you're short on time, you can put them upside down in a skillet with about an inch of water. Cover the skillet and steam them. Then and you put them in upside down, then turn them over and then put in your filling, whatever you want, and it takes an extra 5 minutes. But that's so, you know, some days I like the oven and some days I'm in a hurry, but I want that acorn squash. Which reminds me, I have one in my fridge and I really want to get that out and use it tonight.
And what temperature, if he's doing it in the oven, what's our temperature there?
Oh, I think I do about 350 to 375.
Okay. Good luck, Russ. Let us know how it turns out. I'd love to hear if you can recreate that recipe successfully. That's fantastic. Now, I know one of your cookbooks, Christy, Celebrating Home, is about the joys of finding comfort in home through cooking. I think that's something a lot of us are looking for these days. What are some of your favorite comforting foods that you're making or maybe looking forward to over the holidays?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for asking. Well, if I skip on back to my first book, The Family Table, then it would be the onion souffle, which is a fancy name, not a difficult dish at all to do. The butternut squash soup recipe actually came from Celebrating Home, so I love, love, love that. I have an enchiladas recipe that's good. It's a little more labor intensive, but boy, is it yummy. One of my really kind of quick and easy recipes that I like in Celebrating Home is French country chicken with cranberries and artichokes. And it's just, you know, preheat a skillet, put this chicken in, smooth side down, and saute until it browns, then turn it over. And I always skin my chicken because it's just healthier. And then I cook it on the other side for a little bit and until it registers 165 degrees on a meat thermometer. And then I move them aside, add in some leeks and some onion to the skillet and saute that, stir in cranberries and garlic, and then artichokes. And it's a one-pan meal, but it looks really, really fancy, but it isn't. It is so quick and easy to do. And for holiday time, I really love the orange glazed roasted duck breasts. It is, again, this is another recipe. It looks restaurant quality, but it's really easy to make at home. And most of the recipes that I have in Celebrating Home, I cook in a very practical kind of way because I'm really busy, and so is just about everyone else. And so I like recipes that I can do part way and then go back to it either the next day or later in the day.
That's great advice. I have to jump in. We're all out of time. Thanks to Christy Ross, public TV chef and host. She's just made us all very hungry. Her cookbooks include Celebrating Home. Find some of her fall recipes she shared at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday on Central Time, there are a lot of kinds of insurance on the market. It can be hard to tell what you do and don't need. A financial planner tells us what makes sense and what most of us can skip. That and a lot more coming up Monday on Central Time. I just saw some news about a discovery in Scotland found deep in a Scottish loch, bringing to light a mystery 2,500 years in the making. And the discovery raises questions. How did it get there? Where did it come from? And are there more like it? And would it still taste good if you spread it on toast? As reported a couple months ago in The Scotsman, just seen by me, the discovery was butter. It came from an archaeological site on Loch Tay in Scotland, north of Glasgow and Edinburgh. The butter was found in an Iron Age site dating to around 500 BC, where the buildings, after apparently being abandoned, washed into the waters of the long, skinny lake now known as Loch Tay. The butter was in a wooden butter dish. It looked, to the archaeologist, like a gray smear on the dish. Lab testing confirmed it's dairy material, most likely made from cow's milk. How did it last 2,500 years? According to a researcher, the loch never gives up its butter. Quote, because of the fantastic anaerobic conditions where there's very little light, oxygen, or bacteria to break down anything organic, you get this type of sealed environment. They say this answers questions about available technology and eating habits of Iron Age Scotland, but unanswered in the report, would it still be edible? Apparently there's no sign of a best used by date on the wooden dish. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.